Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with Noel Gallagher.
Welcome to the first in a new series of The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. My guest starting this new series is someone I've wanted on the show for years, a man who genuinely changed the face of British music, helped revitalise guitar rock and wrote some of the most loved songs of the past 20 years, which sounds like an exaggeration, but in his case, is actually true. And he'd definitely agree. My guest on The First Time this week is Noel Gallagher. As he prepares to release his second solo album, Chasing Yesterday, Noel sits down for a special interview to talk about his very first experiences with music, from Leo Sayre to the terraces of Main Road, through to the impact of the Holy Trinity of the Smiths, the Stone Roses and the Jam. He might also mention the Beatles. He also looks back at the very first Oasis rehearsals, their first gigs, and the fame that followed in the wake of their first album, Definitely Maybe. Noel also talks about the night he left Oasis and his feelings about stepping up to become a solo artist. But I started off with asking Noel, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Oh, well, being in an Irish household, my dad was a DJ as well, so I didn't have a... can't remember having a first eureka moment, but my dad had a guitar that he could never play, and I would say first musical moment probably is like my dad putting records together to take to DJ, Irish country and western records. Awful stuff.
Like what?
Oh, really? Do you want to know?
Yeah,
Dermot Hegarty.
I left my father, I left my mother, I left all my friends and relations too.
Charlie Pride, Big Tom and the Mainliners.
I thought I had seen pretty girls in my time. That was before I met you.
The Indians. All kind of Irish kind of social club music, yeah.
Because there's you going to football matches, the big kind of sing-along anthems influenced you.
I used to go see City on the Kippax, which was at the time the longest stand in the whole of England, and it was all standing, so there's about 20,000 in there. And one of City's songs, I still sing it to this day, is a take on Hey Jude by the Beatles. And it goes na 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 City. Yeah, I kind of must have been. And I used to read it when I remember first going as a child and all these people started singing. Well, it's swearing, telling the other lot they were going to get their heads kicked in and all that kind of thing. But yeah, the Hey Jude thing, yeah. It's an amazing sound to hear, sort of like, you know, 20,000 people all singing it. It's great.
You think that's why you have a fondness for an anthem?
I'd like to think so. Most of it's to do with being Irish. The Irish don't write pop music. They write anthems. If you think of all the great songs that have come out of Ireland, most of them are kind of fist in the air whilst you're crying kind of things. You know what I mean? Like, it's like some might say would be the prime example of all of U2 songs and, you know, Hole of the Moon by the Waterboys. They're all about some kind of melancholy and loss, but they're kind of stomping anthems as well, you know.
So. Weddings and Funerals.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, we do. Yeah, we do Weddings and Funerals. Good over there. Oh, yeah.
What's the first single?
The first single I was bought, Won't Let the Show Go On by Leo Sayre, because I think I'd seen him on Top of the Pops dressed as a clown. I remember my dad buying it for me, and the record label it was on, the label on it was something to do with Alice in Wonderland. It might have had the hair of Alice in Wonderland in a top hat. I don't know what kind of label it was, but I remember being bought that. And ironically, I would end up living on the same street as Leo Sayre for a while.
Nice lad.
Never seen him.
All right.
Never seen him. But I know he was on that street because my tour manager at the time also did a bit for him. He said, you know Leo Sayre lives over there. I was like, quick, get in. Oh, he sees us.
Baby.
But the first single that I bought, it would have been a punk single, but I'm not sure. It would have been something by the Sex Pistols. But I specifically remember buying a lot of Jam singles. Or I've remembered buying Stand and Deliver by Adam and the Ants, right? This is the most fascinating thing about the music business these days. It came wrapped in a free poster. And on the side of the poster, it said, limited edition, first 750,000 with free poster. The first 750,000. So the you know, the subsequent 750,000 didn't get one. But it's like, how many 750,000s were they selling? You couldn't sell 750,000 of anything now, could you, on vinyl?
It's difficult to wrap an MP3 in a poster, though.
Well, then Apple are sadly they're failing us all, aren't they?
First album then, yeah?
First album was Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols by the Sex Pistols. I'm afraid, yes, I've always been that cool. It's something that's just dogged me through my life.
What appealed about it?
There was a family who lived on the corner of Burnage Lane, Mark and Tony France. Now, they won't mean anything to you, but I seen this guy, it was either Mark or Tony France, on the high street where we kind of lived, and he had bleached blonde hair, skinhead, and an exclamation mark dyed in black on the back of his head. This was kind of punk time, and it's wow, that's amazing, you know. And the Frances, Mark, Tony, and maybe another one of them would go on to form the band Stockholm Monsters, which were the first band ever to come out of Burnage. Oasis were the second, and punk was just it at the time. I never really hung around with people my age, I always hung around with older lads. I got it because it had swearing on it, if I'm being honest. Because the track Bodies says the F word about 7 times in the second verse, which I always loved. I'm definitely having a bit of that. And I got a copy from Sifters.
What was the first gig you went to then?
First gig was The Damned at Manchester Apollo.
That's a strong first gig.
In 1979, could have been 1980. The only reason I went was because one of my mum's friends was the doorman, and we mithered him about, and he had to wait till all the crowd had gone in. He let us in and stand at the back. I was 11 or 10, and we kind of stood there in the Apollo, which seemed at the time this enormous cathedral of sound. And of course, when you get to play there, you just think, slumming it here, it's small, isn't it? But The Damned were amazing. You didn't realise it at the time, because you were so young, but they were quite crazy affairs, the punk gigs in the 70s. Seats being ripped out and stuff. And The Damned were in their full, that punk goth thing they had going on, Captain Sensible and all that. It was great. I loved The Damned. Loved them.
I got Six Music.
The legend is that this charming man, watching that, that was the first thing that made you think, I want to be a guitarist. Is that right?
It went in three stages. Was seeing the Jam on the Old Grey Whistle Test. They were doing Eton Rifles. And again, seeing Weller, I think he was like 19 at the time, and thinking, my God, he's angry about something. What is he angry about? Which, again, in later life, trust me, the fire has not gone out. I'm going to end up being a neighbour of his, or him being a neighbour of mine, and being kind of friends for 20 years. And he's still, he's mellowed a bit. He's just now quietly seething. So there was the Jam on the Old Grey Whistle Test, and then there was the Smiths doing What Difference Does It Make on Top of the Pops. And Johnny had this big red semi-acoustic guitar, Gibson 335. He's still got his, I've still got mine. I love the Smiths. So it was a combination of the Jam, the Smiths and the Stone Roses. Because the Jam, I was a bit too young for the Jam, do you know what I mean? I was like 10, like a young teenager. So I was a Jam fan, of course, but I wasn't that connected to them in the way, I didn't really understand what they were singing about. You know, I didn't know what Eton Rifles was about. And the Smiths, I loved the Smiths and I was there at the beginning. But I was playing guitar, you know, no one can play guitar like Johnny Marr, and nobody can write lyrics like Morrissey.
True.
So you might as well not bother. You might as well just enjoy it for what it is. But when the Stone Roses came along and I heard Sally Cinnamon, I thought,
I can do that.
I can do that, though. I can do that. So it was a kind of combination of the three that made me think, I reckon I could do it. And it took me a while after that to actually do it, but, you know.
Your eyes are gazing back from it.
When I first started selling cinnamon would have been 1987. Didn't join a band till 91, so it's 4 years after that. Didn't put a record out till 93, so about 6 years after. But that's in between that, I was travelling the world, roadieing,
yeah,
being amazing, stood on the side of the stage. And I was with Mark Coyle, who would go on to co-produce Definitely Maybe with me. And he actually came up with the drum intro for Live Forever, because he was the monitor engineer. And to test the monitors, he would just sit on thing, and all he would play was that. For ages. And I looked after the guitars, and I remember playing those chords. That's how Live Forever started.
Maybe I don't really want to know how your garden grows, 'cause I just want to fly. Lately.
What was the first Oasis rehearsal like that you were when you were part of the band?
Mind-blowing. Not, really? I mean, not mind-blowing in the sense that we sounded like the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Liam had mithered me for about a month to come down and play with us. Come on, man. You write songs. And I was like, I can't be bothered. Acid House and all that, you know what I mean? I wasn't really that keen. Laziness more than anything. They all rehearsed on a Sunday. I was always hungover on a Sunday. One Sunday I went down and I'd been not writing tunes. You know, I could play the guitar and I was writing little bits and things. And they did their three or four songs of what they had. And I remember doing the chords for Columbia, I think, or something like that. And then when I said, well, if I play that, you play this, you play that, and you just go and put the kettle on or something. It's before it had words, it was an instrumental. And when it all kicked in, when you hear your first thing for the first time you played live, that's when the light went on, and then I became obsessed with it. I thought, this is amazing. I'm brilliant.
Because there was a real work ethic there, wasn't there?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, I mean, we weren't working towards anything. I just loved it. I loved playing the guitar. I mean, I'd loved playing the guitar for years. But then when you hear your own music come alive in a room, it was amazing. And we all got on great. We used to have a brilliant laugh. Bonehead, what a funny dude. And Griggs was kind of like Dr. Spock. And Liam was already Liam. Tony was, you know, the typical affable drummer, you know. And we enjoyed hanging out. And then we, you know, that progressed to us getting our own rehearsal room. And then we did it 4 or 5 nights a week. And not because it was like we're going to make it, it's because it was just great. You know, what else was there to do? There's nothing else to do. We were on the dole. Me and Liam were on the dole, do you know what I mean? We used to look forward to be sitting around all day, kind of, you know. This is before Sky Television or any of that. There was nothing to do.
Sky could have ruined the band.
It could have. There was no internet, no mobile phones. We had no money. There was nothing to do except sit indoors all day and hopefully somebody might come round and you would get a little bit high in the afternoon. That was it. And we would like love to go rehearsals because it was kind of, you were out. You know, it was great. And that's where the work ethic came from.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Noel Gallagher. And that was Columbia, the first track that Noel played with Oasis, and actually the first release from the band. It was a limited edition 12-inch promo single in late 93.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music.
You start to recoil. Heavy words are so lightly thrown, but still I leap in front of a flying bullet for you. So what difference does it make? So what difference does it make? It makes none, but now you have gone, and you must be looking very old. We'll find work for idle hands to do. I stole and I lied, and why? Because you asked me to. But now you make me feel so ashamed, because I've only got two hands, but I'm still fond of you. Oh, so what difference does it make?
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music, the show where we look at the first key moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Noel Gallagher. And that was What Difference Does It Make by The Smiths. That was the first Smiths song that Noel fell in love with, having seen them on Top of the Pops in January 1984. Now, the first Oasis gig with Noel actually in the band was at the Boardwalk in Manchester in 1992. I asked Noel about that first live appearance.
People always say, I was terrifying. You know, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. Mark Coyle has a cassette of it. And we did Columbia, which was an instrumental. I think we did five songs. I think two were mine, because they already had three. And one of them was... you're going to love this. One of them was written by Bonehead, and it was an acoustic song that him and Liam sang. Do you know what it was called?
Go on.
Acoustic. I'm not even joking. It was called Acoustic. It's like it's an imaginative... little fella. It was great. What had really kind of got me, because I'd and this is true, I swear to God this story is true, when we went down with Oasis and was kind of doing the thing, and then it was like, should we, because they'd already done one gig when I went to see them, So there was a local band night, used to be on a Tuesday at the Boardwalk, and it was kind of, once we've got, we'll do this night. It didn't dawn on me that I'd never played the guitar stood up. I never owned a strap. I'd been sat on the end of the bed for years, and when I would do the guitars for Graham from the Inspires, I would sit on the drum riser. So I'd never really played the guitar stood up. And when it dawned on me I had to get a strap and do it standing up, it really freaked me out for weeks. I was like, oh no, what? Can I not just sit down?
What was the first Beatles record you fell in love with? We have to do the Beatles question.
She Loves You. I remember it distinctly. I remember it being on holiday in Ireland and it being on the radio. And it's such a great song. It's such a brilliant, brilliant tune. It's like the greatest power pop song of all time. It's 2 minutes and 11 and a half seconds long or something. And it starts off with the chorus. It's just a brilliant tune. Every time I hear it, I just think, wow, I love that song. It's amazing. I guess it kind of defines the Beatles in their fab stage, you know, with the grey suits and the woo and shaking the hair and all that. Brilliant. What a tune. She loves you, yeah.
What was it like when you first met Macca then?
It was great. It was Stella McCartney, who I'd never met, had her first ever fashion show in London in 1994. I was still living in a basement flat in Camden at the time. Somebody called my flat who knew my then girlfriend and had said they're having a party. Stella's having a party, do you want to come across? But they didn't tell me that McCartney was going there because they thought I might freak out kind of thing. So we went to Cavendish Avenue to his gaff, you know. And opened the thing in the gate, oh, and went to the door. Twiggy, answered the door. Twiggy. And we kind of went in and in this hallway and in on the left in this room with, you remember the like embossed wallpaper you used to get, but it was just embossed flowers.
Yeah.
This is all hand painted in. And they used to do it in the 60s when they were tripping. Inside, dancing to Desmond Dekker and the Israelites was Paul McCartney. And they had a jukebox in the room. Somebody said, this is, what's his name, from Oasis? And he went, hey man, great to meet you. And he said something about Slide Away or something. And I happened to have a brown suede jacket on that looked very reminiscent of the cover of Rubber Soul. And I kind of had longish hair. And he said, hey, you look like a Beatle. And I said, so do you. And we had a great night. Linda was an amazing host. She went out and got vegetarian food for us all at silly o'clock in the morning. And then he took me down the bottom of his garden where he has got this big meditation bubble. I don't know if you've seen the pictures.
No.
Some famous pictures of the Beatles. It's literally a glass bubble with a round bed in it. And it's like, you know, like a Christmas shaky thing, what they call snowstorm thing.
Yeah.
It's literally like that at the bottom of his garden, right? And you get in, and me and him got in, and he pressed this button, and the bed goes up into a tinier bubble. And he said, yeah, we used to kind of sit out here, you know, in the 60s and look at the stars. And it was just me and him. And I was thinking, You better not try and get off with me.
Did he?
No, I tried to get off with him. He's an amazing dude. He's a proper geezer, man. I love him.
I want to ask you about the Kinks. When did you first fall in love? Village Green's the one you talk about a lot. Or you have,
I think it's their best album, yeah. I really started to listen to them and collect all their songs. I mean, obviously, I've been listening to them all my life, but really allowing myself to be influenced by them. You could say ripping off. I don't care. That's all right. That's what makes the game go round. I'd say in the 2000s, I'd say. But kind of dawns on you that really they go on about the Beatles and the Stones and the Who, but really Ray Davies... Song for song, he's probably a better songwriter than all of them put together. He's the quintessential English songwriter. You know, is there a better song from 1967, 68 than Waterloo Sunset? Really, when we're thinking about it. Yeah. The Stones were a great band, and the Beatles were a great studio band, boffins, almost scientists. But the Kinks were something else, you know. You listen to that album, Village, it's storytelling of the highest order. It's amazing. The lyrics... to that particular track, We Are the Village Green, is unbelievable. And I've lucky enough to meet him on a few occasions.
Grumpy lad.
Oh, let me tell you this. I was at an award ceremony and I got asked to present him with an award. And I kind of went up there and said, you know, why is he not called Sir Ray Davies? And I give him the big, you know. And he'd been sat at my table. He kind of got up and I was clapping. And the first thing he said was, what a lousy speech. And I was like, nice one, thanks for that. You know, and I've had a couple of afternoons with him. He then presented me with my Ivor Novello, which, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that, you know, for your outstanding song collection to be presented by Ray Davies. And he gave a great speech, and I thought, I'm going to pay him back for that. But I never did because I love him too much. He's great. I mean, he's great. He's a true unsung hero of the 60s. Amazing. Have you ever heard Love Me Till the Sun Shines from the BBC sessions?
No.
You got to get that album. So it's all their kind of Top Gear sessions right the way through to mid-70s. Honest to God, the versions. Waterloo Sunset's amazing. Absolutely. There's a drum fill in it that's not on the record that'll blow your mind.
Here on Top of the Pops, we could say it's time for old time as we hear revived live that great hit Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks.
Dirty old river, must you keep rolling?
When did you get your first royalty check and what did you do with it?
Ah.
Was it a biggie?
No. The one after that was big. The fourth one was the one, though. Because it was the Morning Glory one.
Right.
What did I do with it? To be honest, what did I do with it? I'm not sure. So if we put out April, that October, it would have been nothing. I would have paid a hotel bill somewhere or clothes, probably. I've never been one for cars. I'm not really one for jewellery and all that kind of thing. I would have bought clothes and the dreaded drugs and lots of booze and probably more than one or two family packs of Square Crisps, I would have thought.
With the big royalty check, though, is that the one when you're like, Mum, you know, mortgage, got that one sorted?
That was the one, yeah.
That was
the one where you start looking at houses, like big houses. But, yeah, I remember getting a phone call. I was still living in the basement flat in Camden, number 83A Albert Street. And somebody from my office called me and said, we're just about to put £1 million in your bank account. And I'm not bragging about this, but I'd been up all night. And I was just like, you know, yeah, okay, whatever. And just carried on, you know, carried on doing whatever it was we were doing, listening to Captain Beefheart or something. But they were great. Never looked back since then.
There was that point with What's the Story when the planet seemed to shift on its axis a little bit and you couldn't do anything without getting... You had a haircut and it was like...
I went on to the front page of the Sun.
The front page of the Sun because you had a haircut.
I was skinhead.
I mean, how does, for all your confidence, how does that affect you? That's gonna...
Do you know what? I treat the entire thing, the game, the business, whatever you want, as just one huge joke. Because if you start to worry about things like that, you know, you end up in rehab, you know what I mean? I was out with Chris Martin one night and he banged his fist on the table in frustration because he's very serious about everything. Everything. And he was going on about, I don't know, people hating Coldplay or whatever. And I was kind of laughing, going, why do you care? How much money you got in the bank? Right then. So, you know. And he banged his hand on the table in frustration and said, why do you not take anything seriously? And I was like, because it's a joke. Even this situation here is a joke. We're sat in the smallest room in the BBC talking about things that happened 20 years ago. You can't take that seriously. I used to open my door in St John's Wood at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning trying to go out to get some cigarettes, you know, with a primal scream all passed out in the front room. And there'd be 20 Japanese people stood outside. You laugh now because it's funny.
Yeah.
But I was never like, you know, oh, I can't go out. I'd walk past laughing at them, going, where are you lot from? What, you've come all the way from Tokyo for my autograph? Oh, do us a favour. Go over the thing now, will you, and get us 20 Bensons. Come back, I'll sign your little picture for you. Fame is to be enjoyed. If you take yourself seriously, you're an idiot.
There was never a moment around the time of Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, you know, it seemed to be quite a fractious kind of time. And
another thing that would vaguely give a second thought to was whether the stuff that I was getting up to was affecting or hurting other people. That was it. Now, my mum, still to this day, we'll get doorstepped by a journalist when Liam's done something ridiculous, like, you know, try to shove a dog through a letterbox or, you know, do you know what I mean? Or set fire to a priest or something. You know, that's when she would be saying, I've got journalists outside my house and we'd have to send some of the lads round. But other than that, I didn't care about any of it. All the stuff that used to be right in the paper. I mean, I constantly would kind of go to the paper shop and see the headlines and just think, that doesn't look good in print. That looks terrible. You know, but I was like, I don't care. I don't care. Genuinely do not care.
When did you first think, I've had enough of this?
Oh, that night in Paris. That was it. It wasn't like 4 months seething leading up to it. We were never that band that would go off.
So no one ever left officially before and then came back again or anything like that?
Oh, I'd kind of walked off tours, but I'd never really left. Once I left and that was it. I'd walked off tours because, you know, you got to understand, man, we're drinking a lot, you know, and doing all the rest of it. And they were kind of crazy times. And in my heart, physically, I'd left the tour. In there, I'd never left. Mm. But we were never the kind of band, you know, that would be off sulking to the tour manager about somebody. They end in fights, you know, and some of them fist fights. But it was always out in the open, always. Every drummer we ever sacked, he knew it was coming, trust me.
And you never had any second thoughts afterwards? After posting that message and going, that's it.
No, I sat in a car outside the festival. My security guard just turned around and he said, what are we doing? We're staying or going. And I knew the band were on in 10 minutes.
Seriously? Wow.
And I just thought, I've had enough. And I said to the driver, LA, let's go. You know, and that was it. And the minute he took off, I knew then, you know, and I kind of called my manager and said, I've quit, and that's it. And he freaked out.
What happened?
He freaked out. He was then trying to manage the situation. As I sent him this text, that's it, I've had enough. About 40 minutes later, he's not at the gig. He's somewhere else in England doing something, playing golf or something. And I'm back at the hotel, sat on the balcony drinking champagne, smoking. And he sends me this text, don't do anything stupid, whatever you do, stay there. And I was like, I think you're about 45 minutes too late, mate. I've left. And then it was a case of, okay, well, you know, I better not go back to England. So I flew my wife and kids out. So we hired a private jet and just flew around the Mediterranean for 2 or 3 weeks. And then went back to England and thought, it'll have died down. Now, by the time we got back in, it was kind of like, you know, it hadn't died down. It's still going on, actually.
Still hasn't died down. First solo record, I mean, you've always been really confident about your songwriting. Was there underneath that this, like, if people don't get this record, I'm gonna have to a proper job?
I tell you how confident I was. The Death of You and Me was the first single. Now, if I was in any way a bit nervous about what was happening, one of the bangers would have been like What a Life would have been the first single, you know, or if I had gone, it would have been all bells and whistles. And I thought, no, I'm going to, no, because we always used to do that in Oasis, grandstanding with the first two singles, you know. And I thought, this is different now. I'm going to be a bit cooler than this. Been in LA for 4 months on my own. Of course, I hadn't been going out, wasn't drinking. That led to not really doing a great deal of smoking. So you adopt the LA lifestyle, was eating healthy, a lot of big salads, you know. So I was physically strong when I came back to England with the record. Therefore, I was mentally strong. But I knew it was a great record. I knew it. And I was proved right yet again. It's a burden.
What's the last track we'll play?
Okay, you have to find for me a song by a band called The Real McCoy, and it's called I Get So Excited. They're an Irish band. This is obscure we're talking about here. It was recorded in the late 60s. And trust me, when you hear this, you'll think, why have I not heard that song before? It is incredible. There's only two people in the world that I know who know this song, and that's me and Johnny Marr.
That's the song we'll finish on.
It's amazing. Amazing.
Thanks very much, man.
No worries, man.
BBC Radio 6 Music. Yeah.
This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six Music. Right now, this is Handpicked.
Hello, this is Handpicked, a weekly playlist put together by Six Music that you can download in BBC Sounds. Now, usually Handpicked is full of new music, but this week we squeezed in as many legendary punk bands and tracks as we can fit into half an hour, all of which were played by Craig Charles in his Trunk of Punk while he's been in for Steve Lamacq on Six Music. Steve's back this week every day from 4. The full version of this Handpicked punk mix will be out on Wednesday. Just search Handpicked in BBC Sounds to find it. But for now, a half our blast of punk, starting with Buzzcocks.
I'm in love again. Been like this.